As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today we'll hear part two of my interview with musician and songwriter Kathy Valentine. We discuss Kathy's contribution to the Go-Go's hit, Head Over Heels. We also talk about the band's recent documentary. We explore her memoir a bit more, including the soundtrack she wrote to accompany it. And we talk about the Go-Go's latest single, Club Zero. First, though, we'll hear some of Head Over Heels, the 1984 hit song from the Go-Go's, co-written by Kathy and Charlotte Coffey. After that, I'll be back on the line with Kathy for part two of your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Up from where we left off, Kathy, here's a question I'm not really clear on. Is that when you were asked to fill in for Margot, those New Year's Eve shows, and that's your first time playing with the Go-Go's, were you still in the Textones or had you already left the Textones?
I had left the Textones about 3 months prior. Okay. And it was the first time I hadn't been in a band since I was 16. So I'm 21, and which doesn't seem like a long time, but I'm like a few months without being in a band, and I felt very lost and didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought I didn't want to be a solo artist. I always wanted to be in a band, like the Stones were my template. You know, I wanted to be the Keith, and I always wanted to find the Mick, you know, and that was my template for what a band was. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And when I met Charlotte and she asked me if I could play bass, I just thought, well, they're happening. People like this band and this will be something to do. And it really was thinking more in terms of like kind of something to do. I wasn't expecting to fall in love with them. I was not expecting that. And I did. Learning the songs, being around them, going on stage at the Whiskey to 8 consecutive shows that were sold out, and the crowd is just going wild for this band. And it was like, I started the book with this feeling because it was just all I had ever wanted in so many ways since I had started playing.
So I was just wondering, since Charlotte, you know, tracked you down to ask you to fill in for Margot, do you think if Margot hadn't have been sick, that they still would have tracked you down to get you to join the band at some point as a replacement for Margot?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you never know. I mean, you can always wonder, but I don't know if things are meant to be or kismet or destiny and something else would have happened. But I think there was something right about the five of us, because once we played together, it seemed like it wasn't going to stop. You know, what was meant to be temporary, I think we all felt pretty soon that this was not going to go back.
We've spoken about Vacation, which was a big hit you brought to the band. And another track you contributed to that was also a sizable hit is 1984's Head Over Heels. So you had the you contributed the lyrics and Charlotte did the music, or what was the process with that one?
Yeah, we had a rough time. Let's see, I'm trying to remember the chronology. I think we'd had a little bit of a rough time. I guess that was before she'd had carpal tunnel syndrome, I think. Yeah. And we'd had our first break in a while, and I felt very lost in that loose ends. And when the machine started gearing up again, you know, a producer was chosen, I think, and it was determined that we were going to make the next album. I went to Charlotte's and she played me piano part, and I hadn't seen her play piano. I'd never seen that. Mm-hmm. And except maybe on We Got the Beat, I think she just pounded some chords on that, but it wasn't like anything we'd done live. It had never been part of our live show or rehearsals or anything. So she's playing this great piano, and to me, it just sounds like, I wouldn't say Nicky Hopkins, but I'm just thinking, oh, this is a whole new thing, you know? And I hadn't heard it. And I was just, I said, please let me work on this song with you. I love this song. And I had lyrics. I just found the lyrics a couple of months ago when I was looking through stuff, but I have all the lyrics like that I pulled out and started showing her. And again, I think that's one of my favorite songs that we do.
So this documentary is airing on Showtime right now. How long did it take to put it together?
Well, I did my interview in November of 2018. Okay. So it took almost that whole year we started talking about it around January when I got back in the band. I'd been out of the band for several years, and it had been a really unpleasant kind of divorce from the band. It had been a tough time, and that's when I wrote my book, as a matter of fact. But the musical came out, amends were made, apologies were expressed, and the world was right again. And our manager approached us about doing a documentary, and as you can imagine, it wasn't the first time we'd been approached, and there was a lot of resistance from some, and some there wasn't. And even when everybody got on board, it was still this long process of just kind of negotiating and getting the team together. So I would say it was a 2-year thing from the time it finally got onto Showtime. And it premiered in Sundance in January. And one of the big losses in my world from the pandemic is that we were also going to do several festivals, and we had a really big theatrical release, that partnership that we were going to announce at Tribeca. I guess I shouldn't say who the company was, but it was major. And it was going to be in theaters worldwide. And then that's pandemic. So enormous loss, just a huge loss to not have that happen. But things are what they are. And now it's out. And I'm blown away by the response it's getting. And it's really doing what I hoped, which is celebrate and uplift the Go-Go's and our achievements. We've really not always gotten our due.
Well, absolutely. In the movie, there's talk of a lot of drug use by Brad and the band, but we actually see, you know, Charlotte, Kathy, the segment they're talking about her going into rehab, and that's discussed. And you had started drinking and doing drugs at a really, really young age. When was it that you started going to Alcoholic Anonymous?
I got sober at the age of 30, 3 weeks after my 30th birthday. And it's a weird thing because, you know, I think in my mind, I always had this sense of like, you know, I didn't want to quit because I thought, you know, how do you have fun if you're not drinking and stuff and partying? Right. How do you have fun? So to me, the whole thing was you don't quit. You just do it. You get it under control, which is its own kind of hell when you're just trying to control yourself all the time. Not a nice way to live. So I was pretty burned out on and always making these rules like, oh, I'm only going to drink on Saturday or whatever. and then my life, it just felt like nothing was working out. I mean, like the Go-Go's, I couldn't stop comparing myself to all the rest of the girls. And it seemed like everybody else was moving forward and their careers were moving forward. And I'm putting together band after band, and they're good bands, and I'm writing good songs and good players, but nothing just seemed to work out. I think I finally just felt like if I quit drinking, something will change, because I felt like nothing was changing. And I thought if this one thing changes, then that's something that's different. What I didn't know is that everything would change, and it is the foundation of the best, my best life and my best self I've ever been. Mm-hmm. But I was 30 years old, and I also had this sense, I think, that if, by the time you're 30, I was like, it's one thing to be a teenager and crazy. It's one thing to be in your 20s, but when you get something about 30, now it just seems like you're a youngster, but I felt like when you're 30, it's time to be a grown-up, and you got to be responsible, and you got to have your shit together, and if you can't control what you're doing, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
There's a moment in the film when you're reflecting on Jane Whedon's departure, about how she wanted to sing a song she felt really personal about, and how the rest of the band shot it down, and how at the time, you and the rest of the band members really couldn't wrap your heads around the idea of people not being in their place, performing in their box, and that there was no really artistic growth in a sense. So where are the Go-Go's with that now collectively? If you write a song, can you sing it if you want?
I don't think so. I think it's still got, I think it is what it is, and it's not really a moving forward band. There's a sense when you're in a band, especially when you're young, where everybody's kind of on the same page. It just doesn't really work if you're not. Everybody's not going to do other things. Everybody's not going to be in other bands. There's a point in time for a band to succeed where you're just kind of all got the same goal in mind and you're all on the same page. And I don't know, for us, that stopped happening after we broke up. We could funnel it for a short period of time. When we got back together and like a greatest hits comes out, or we make God Bless the Go-Go's in 2000, but it's never going to be, this is it. It's all for one. And one, it's never going to be that again, because people's lives your life gets bigger and bigger. The older you get, you got your home and your family and your pets and other things you do that fulfill you. So when we, somewhere in the 2000s, when we were playing and touring, I wanted to add Mad About You to the set, and I wanted to add Jane doing Rush Hour, and I suggested Cool Places, and even then that was resistance, and it took, the band is like a democracy. You got to lobby. You got to just like lobby and get people on your side that agree with you, and then it's just crazy. And it ended up being a really good thing for us. But I'm open to doing it. But, we're all really different now. We have different taste in music. It's amazing. It's one thing to do a documentary, but it's amazing we got a song done with Club Zero. It's amazing. Right. Because we're just really different people with really different lives with a bond. It's complicated. We still have a bond. And we still are enjoying the hell out of what's happening now. And we're in touch. We have a text chain, and we do Zoom calls and stay in touch, and we're close, and the bond is intact. But man, that's what you're asking would mean that we're a band, and that's what we're doing, and this is what we need to do to stay functioning.
Well, I'm going to ask you more about Club Zero, because that's what we'll go out on. But a couple other questions before we are kind of out of time here. How old is your daughter now?
17. She's going to be 18 and vote for the first time. And this is in October. She turns 18.
Okay. Well, my daughter as well is 18, and she'll be voting like your daughter for the first time this fall. In fact, she starts going off to college in a couple of weeks. So I'm on the verge of being an empty nester, and that's tough. But my question is this. So she's 18, and I am the most uncool parent in the world. Okay. And so relatives will tell her, you must think your dad's cool being on the radio and all, but they're saying that to her, and you can literally see her eyes rolling so far back in her head, you think she's going blind or having an epileptic fit or something. So what is your daughter like regarding the Go-Go's? Is this a cool thing, or is it mom and her old rock and roll friends? I can't believe they play that old music. What is her take on all this?
Well, it's she's really proud. I mean, she's so proud, and she thinks it's really cool. And her friends think it's cool. And her friend's mom thinks it's cool. And some of her teachers think it's cool. So that's all. And she doesn't feel overshadowed by it. You know, it's not like I'm so relevant that anyone's like trying to be her friend to know, you know what I mean?
Right,
it's not like she's, it's not like, I can't even think of anybody. I'm that person. But, so she's into it. When she was little, she would come on the road with me and the band would let her kind of dance on stage. I've got video and photos of her dancing on stage with the Go-Go's when she was little. And she saw me in 2018 at the Hollywood Bowl with them, and she was 16. And I don't think it had ever really dawned on her till that moment, the kind of impact or that this was a big deal, you know. Mm-hmm. Seeing your mom on stage at the Hollywood Bowl, that seemed like, she seemed stunned. And then we just watched the documentary the other night, and she just loved it.
Right. Well, tell me about, you know, the memoir and her. I mean, was she aware of any of this backstory? You're growing up. I mean, the specifics of your adolescence.
No.
So
I had alluded to some stuff, and she was young when I started the memoir. She was probably 12 or 13. So I don't think she was like, she wasn't ready for it then, but it took me a while to write it. And as she got older, she saw how hard I worked on it. And I talked about things, and she wasn't real comfortable with some of it, but I said, you know, wait and see, you know, and I told her why I thought it was important. I told her why I thought it was important that I share very personal stuff, because that's what she didn't understand. She's like, why would you want people to know this stuff? Like, you know, why would you do that? And I expressed why once I figured out why myself, why I would want to put that out there. And I think she's just really proud, and she's heard, like, when it first came out, I think she was worried by what some of her friends' moms would think, but she's mm-hmm. seen me get phone calls and texts and cards in the mail of people just saying how much they admire the story and how much they love the story. So we're good. She hasn't read it all. She told me she's leafed through it, read parts. She hasn't read it cover to cover yet.
So you made a soundtrack to accompany the memoir. Who thought of doing that?
It was my idea, and I thought of it at one point. I thought, well, this would be cool, and part of it was practical. I'm really practical, and part of me was thinking, like, you know, who cares? Who's going to care that the bass player wrote a book? Who's going to care that, you know, who I am? I'm not famous. I'm not, you know, I'm not the high-profile person. And so there was a couple of things I thought. Number one, it's not done very often. It's something that might interest people. What I didn't expect was what a great time I would have doing it. And also, when I finished the book, I really missed music. I had really focused on sitting there with my Word documents instead of my Pro Tools, and I missed making music. And I've been seeing a guy in New York who's a fabulous composer, and he was inspiring me. He was making amazing records, and he offered to mix it for me, and I just started doing it and was so in love with the process because it felt very freeing. Not only did I not have to go to band people and say, oh, what do you think of this? And have them go, oh, no, that's too country. That's too 70s. That's too bluesy. That, you know, I didn't have to have anybody putting, you know, the constraints on me. And not only that, I didn't have the constraints of song structure, because when you think of it as a soundtrack, it's like, okay, I can riff on guitar here, I can go into a bass thing, I can do a spoken word over this beat, I can do whatever I want. So it was awesome. I had a blast doing it. And in fact, my next book, I want to be a collection of literary short stories that also have soundtracks to each one.
Oh,
so it's something I'm really, really into, this intersection of storytelling and combining it with music. And now, even when I read a book, I start thinking like, oh, I'd like to put a soundtrack to this book. If I like what I'm reading or that something inspires me, And I like it because, I mean, I'm 61 and I'm probably not going to be having hits in a band and touring. So finding something artistic that is exciting and fun and challenging is really cool.
Well, okay. So the tracks, when I was listening to them, they got shuffled around. So I just listened to the first thing that the computer had listed, which was the song Just Do It. And I hadn't read any of the memoir at that point. I just listened to that first song, and that pretty devastated there. Really, really heavy thing describing this rape that you were suffering through. And then I wind up reading the passage later in the book, and it's like, oh, kind of going through it a second time. Which was harder, writing about it the first time or putting it to music?
The song opened the box, and I grieved for 3 days. As soon as I sang that chorus, because I was just messing with the guitar, I didn't know what the verses were going to be. And as soon as I sang the line, "If I can't stop you, I can let you." And there was something about that line, like it was like, oh, it was like a key to these feelings that even with 30 years of sobriety and, you know, have I had my time in therapy and all that, nothing had opened that. And for the first time, it just came out, and I started sobbing. I was just sobbing. I couldn't sing it anymore. I couldn't play it anymore. And it went on and on for days. It was crazy. And I thought, I can't believe this is all coming out. And there was just something about that line and that melody that tapped into that feeling of feeling so powerless and so in a situation, and that the only power you have is to let them. That's the power. Yeah. And there was something about feeling like, why wasn't anyone protecting me? Why wasn't anybody looking out for me? It was really intense. So it's wild that you heard that first before reading that. And a lot of people have told me that song. I mean, that was the second song I did on the soundtrack, and I played it for some people, and they would either say, "Stop, stop it. I can't listen to this," or I need to gather myself, or they would be in tears. So yeah. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but that's what it is.
I think, you know, it's a story that you needed to tell, and both the written word and the soundtrack are, you know, very, very powerful retellings of it. You've had a number of projects since the Go-Go's initial demise and different projects you've had in between spurts of activity. So the Bluebonnets had an album in 2017 called Tone Wrecker. Are the Bluebonnets still active?
Yeah, but not as much. One of the things about writing my book was that I felt like was, man, I have spent my entire musical career putting all my considerable energy and force and effort into a collective. And writing a book, it was like, that's for me, and that's me. All of a sudden, I'm putting myself out there, and I kind of liked it. And I thought, I never wanted to be a solo artist. That's not what I want, but I do feel like I could put some effort and energy into just being Kathy Valentine for a while, whether that is writing and music and a comic. Like, the idea of just going out and putting a band together and being the singer, that's not what I'm into. But the idea of doing literary stuff combined with music, combined with, I don't want to say motivational, but, you know, just kind of relating to people. The same as when I'm in a band, I like connecting and relating, and to do something where I can kind of do that, just being me, is really, it's something I want. I want while I'm still kind of able to do it. And I feel like I have a platform, you know. I think I have more than other people that build careers have sometimes. But also, I do love the Bluebonnets. We just did a video that's going to be on a fundraiser in conjunction with Morrison Hotel Gallery for Music Cares and NEVA, the National Independent Venue Association. And we're part of a huge online concert on Saturday. That's going to be cool. So I had to learn a lot of video software. And I'm doing my own song, too. I'm going to do Vacation with Tony Scalzo from Fastball. So I'm excited about that.
Oh, great.
And yeah. So that'll all be on this 10-hour concert on Saturday. And I love the Blue Bonnets. I love playing in a band. I'm a musician, pretty much. That's my basic baseline. I'm a musician that likes to go play, whether it's with the Go-Go's playing bass, you know, on a big scale, or whether it's throwing my amp in the trunk and going down to the Continental Club or Antone's and playing guitar. I like it. That's what I like to do. But I also got to think about, you know, growing and expanding and making a living, all that kind of stuff. It's
all like good stuff.
All reality. Yeah.
Well, at the end of the documentary, it shows the Go-Go's working on this new song, Club Zero. That's since come out as a new single, just out a couple of weeks, really. We're going to play that in a moment. So that is something that Jane wrote?
Well, Jane and me and Charlotte and Anna Warnaker from That Dog wrote it together. But Jane brought in a set of lyrics, and Charlotte and Anna had some music that Charlotte thought would go with it. And then I had some lyric ideas that I thought helped define what the song was about some more, and just send them in. It's like I'm fine with writing. I just send stuff in that I think is good, and you know, you like any of this, you're welcome to use it. So I don't get real ego wrapped up in songwriting when you're collaborating. It's not very productive. It's kind of, you just want it to be, I'm really about the song. I want the song to be the best it can be, whether I'm coming up with the bass part or coming up with a harmony or lyrical ideas. I think the song is what serves what everybody should be serving.
Well, new single, any plan in the future for another full length album?
I don't know how, I mean, with this band, you never know, because it's like, you know, I would have never thought there would be a star on Hollywood Boulevard. I would have never thought I'd get kicked out of the band. I would have never thought that we would have a musical on Broadway, a documentary, a song in 2020. So with this band, I've kind of learned to just, I don't really plan it or know. I mean, it doesn't seem like there would be another album, but things have happened that I certainly didn't expect. So I just kind of go with the flow. I'm certainly not going to be trying to push people or pull people into things. That's not what I want to do at this age in music.
Right. Well, Kathy, I know you've got to catch another call here in a moment. So thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it and thoughtful and insightful your questions are. So I appreciate that a lot. Thank you.
Well, you're very, very sweet for saying that. Let's go out now with that new Go-Go single. It's Club Zero in Little Steven's Underground Garage. We heard some of Club Zero just now in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's the latest single from the Go-Go's. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Kathy Valentine for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, both parts 1 and 2. And please join us again next week for your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.